two versions of the verse for this month, Taming the Ox. The whip and rope are necessary, else the ox may stray off down some dusty road. Being well trained, it becomes naturally gentle. Thus, unfettered, then unfettered, it obeys its master. Another version. The whip and tether cannot be put aside, or the ox may wander into mud-filled swamps. When patiently trained to trust, it becomes gentle and can be unfettered. Then, freely, it follows your way. All right, so nice to see everyone. So let's do a little recap talk on this picture of the ox herding pictures. So if you can recall the image, it's a picture of this, you know, little small guy holding on to this big ox. But unlike the last picture of trying to catch the ox, it's not a taunt rope. He's not struggling against the ox, trying to tame it or trying to catch it, really. It's much more of the ox is becoming tame. It's becoming more under the will of this little guy. Now, the ox is interesting. As we look at these pictures, what it means can mean different things. So from an early perspective, or kind of overarching, we look at the ox as being our true nature, kind of understanding that, trying to seek that, trying to find that. We can also look at it in this picture as simply our attention, the sense of steadiness, of samadhi, of continuity, of attention, of the mind itself. And these pictures are so powerful in their teaching because just the image itself has multiple levels that we can look at. We can look at it from a very practical level of how we train our minds to have that steadiness. And we can also look at it as this deeper lesson of why is there ox and the person separate? Because later on in these series, the ox and the people, the person, become one and the same. The ox disappears. So we're going to touch upon both of those tonight. So there's two versions I'm liking to read from this verse. The first one is, and that's on the website, the whip and rope are necessary. Else the ox may stray off down some dusty road. Being well trained, it becomes naturally gentle. Then unfettered, it obeys its master. Right? The second version is the whip and tether cannot be put aside, or the ox may wander into mud-filled swamps. When patiently trained to trust, it becomes gentle and it can be unfettered. And then freely, it follows your way. So you can look at these verse in kind of three sections. The training and discipline, holding in the whip and their tether, the rope, becoming tamed and gentle, and then following our direction willingly. And what does that mean? What does that show up as our practice? So while you're practicing tonight, anyone have their mind wander at all? Anyone have any hindrance visit them, any sloth and torpor, any restlessness, any doubt, any craving, aversion, right? So how did you meet those? How did you work with those when the mind wandered? How did you meet sloth and torpor, right? The phrase here that unless we have our firmness of training, the ox or our attention will wander off down some dusty road. Or the other version, go into some mud-filled swamp. She had both of those. Yeah, I had a little bit of sloth and torpor, and feels like you're stuck in a mud-filled swamp. You're just kind of drifting off. But how do you come out of that? How do you recognize that? How do you bring your attention back? That's where this whip and the rope come together. Now, whip and rope can be kind of a dramatic image for us right now, how that sense of violence or sense of overpowering, it's really pointing toward this firmness of intention, this firmness to bring our attention back. And how do we do that? And how do we learn to do that in a way that actually trains our minds, trains our attention versus causing more inner tension. So certainly many of us start off practice with this hyper-developed inner critic, you know, the perfectionist. And so we find ourselves, you know, we use that throughout our lives to go through whatever training we've gone to have a job, whatever schooling, our relationships, how we run our households, these all come out. And then you start to meditate. Of course, we're going to use that same strategy to keep ourselves back on the breath. And anyone who's practiced for a while starts to realize that that strategy of judging yourself every time you get lost in thought starts to build a level of tension, a level of tightness around the meditation. Like you're really fighting with yourself. That's what last month's picture of trying to catch the ox is part of that struggle that we often have to learn to go through that stage, to try to use that strategy until it finally exhausts itself. And we see the futility in that strategy. All right, so this is a very practical, down-to-earth picture from this perspective, is that how do we bring our attention back again and again? These dusty roads, the mud-filled swamps, you know, the way that thoughts, I love this image of it may wander off down some dusty road or wander into some mud-filled swamp. So there's the hindrance side of it. There's also just the way that our minds like to think. We like to go into planning, or we like to go into worry, believe it or not. We like to go into fantasy. And our untrained mind just goes right down those pathways. And this is the practice of learning to come back, to recognize that impulse to go down. This is the pulling back that ox, training the ox. And how do we bring that sense of firmness, you know, that sense of, you know, the actually word tether and rope. I mean, we literally use the word anchor for much of our training. Have something like the anchor of the breath, that everything else you release it except that anchor, at least at a particular mode or stage in our meditative training. Eventually that anchor can be released just as it becomes released in these pictures. So training and discipline. Then the next stage is when that ox starts to become tamed and gentle. So being well trained, it becomes naturally gentle. The other translation is when patiently trained to trust, it becomes gentle. I like that one, when patiently trained to trust. So we trust the ox, our minds start to trust our intentionality, starts to trust why we're practicing. What's the reason for our practicing? When that trust starts to develop, then we become more gentle. Anyone who's ever trying to train like a pet or a dog in particular, there's a way that you can start to, the dog starts to trust you, starts to know you're really there to support it. Then it starts to want to please you, wants to follow you, wants to listen to your instructions. Unless you're like my dog who sometimes prioritizes some smell or a squirrel over my call to come back. Yeah, that's why the whip and the tether, the rope and the whip are still needed, because that our minds still wander. And this picture, there's starting to be there's this transformation that from our early stages of meditation, when our minds are so busy, it just feels like every other thought, every other breath, we're lost in thought. Eventually, we start to find that stabilizes to some degree. We can actually track a few breaths. We actually start to observe what's arising and passing away in the moment. That's this stabilizing of the mind, the firmness of the mind that comes through training, that comes through practice, comes through regular practice. I just finished a 6-week intro to meditation class, and it was delightful to hear students as they go through this progression in their own training of their mind. And they start to have this shift when they're not having to work so hard. They're not having to struggle so much to pay attention, that there's this naturalness that just starts to come forth more and more. And this particular tradition that Sims is part of, the Thai Forest, kind of the Western Vipassana style of practice, there's this naturalness that we start to incline more and more toward. Once we have enough of that firmness, then we can start to allow the natural attention to be there. So we're not always having to track where our attention is every time. We're shifting really the locus of our attention. So the sense of the becoming tame and gentle. This is when the meditation feels like it's almost starting to run itself, that we're not having to be so involved in it. This, of course, shows up in meditation through training, but also you start to see it in daily life, just ways your mind is naturally at rest, naturally present. Maybe seeing a beautiful sunset, seeing the beauty of nature. Maybe being with a dear friend or maybe a newborn baby. The mind is just, okay, I'm just present. There's not this sense of having to haul it back. And the final section is once it becomes tamed and gentle, then it follows our direction willingly. It obeys its master. Follows our way. So this is the quality of this type of practice is called insight practice. So we often spend a lot of time cultivating the container or the kind of the stability of mind to be able to actually see, observe, to not add anything to the moment's experience, to see clearly. Once that starts to get established, once that ox starts to become tamed or our attention becomes tamed, becomes more stabilized, once it starts to have a gentleness to it, that we're not having to force it so much, then there really is a sense of direction of where we rest our attention. What are we focusing on? And more importantly, why are we focusing our attention on a particular thing? So sometimes we get stuck in just focusing on our breath because that's what we've always done. But the purpose of focusing on the breath is to develop the clarity of seeing and the lack of distortion of seeing so we can actually understand the Four Noble Truths. We can actually understand the origin of dukkha, the cessation of dukkha, to direct our attention toward those qualities. Not in an abstract way, but how it actually shows up in this very moment, in this moment of sitting, this moment of listening, this moment of relating to a friend, a partner. How does it show up in relationships? That's really the integration of our practice with our daily life, is we can start to turn our attention and actually see. This is, it sounds maybe a little obscure or obtuse, but just next time you find yourself triggered by something, that's an opportunity for practice. You know, why am I triggered here? There's, of course, the psychological, there's a relational piece, and there's also the Dharma piece. There's also the dharmic piece of how you take form, how you identify, how you create that sense of you in the midst of that rub, that friction with life. What if you actually turn that friction not as a problem, but as actually a gift? I can actually learn something about how I identify. It's like a custom-built spiritual path, your life. The difficulties of your life, the joys of your life, those worldly winds. And so this is the direction of following willingly. Of course, the next picture is riding the ox home back to where we our true reside, our true abode, back to the sense of our true nature. So this is kind of talking about it in a very practical way of how our meditation unfolds. And I just want to take a couple minutes to speak about this other aspect of this picture. Because the ox and the person, they're clearly two different things, right? The person is really dealing with the ox, focusing on the ox, trying to train the ox, tame the ox. But the ox and the person, there's a duality, there's a separation. There's a schism, a division between the ox and the person. Now, if the ox represents our true nature, there's a trouble with that. There's actually that schism. And yet, you know, usually we practice because we have been conditioned to see through schism, through division, through separation. That's how we have to practice until eventually that schism falls apart. So this picture still has that really intact. Okay, there's the ox, and then there's a little guy trying to control the ox, trying to tame the ox. And sometimes we stay, that's where we stop our practice. We say, okay, that's good enough, because I feel that sense of being, my mind being gentle, my attention being steady, and it feels really good. And that's kind of where we maybe stop or kind of rest. But this is just halfway through. This is just halfway through these series. And then these pictures take a very interesting turn, that suddenly the next picture is not this cord between the ox and the person that's slack this time, tense, you know, taunt last month, but actually the ox and the person are riding, they're on top of each other. They're physically touching each other. And the next picture after that, the ox is forgotten. The ox is forgotten, something we've spent so much energy trying to find, trying to seek, discover, to catch, to tame, and then it's gone. And then the next picture, the self is forgotten, right? And then there's the sense of unity. So on a deep level, these series really point toward separation, duality, and non-duality. And really taking in the duality right now, really seeing that duality that shows up every time that we meditate, there's a sense of me as a meditator. Me who's observing, me who's working with this thought, working with this hindrance. It's helpful to be able to do that. But just to realize that's not where it ends. That sense of leading the ox, it's eventually looking at that very sense of separation to actually see through that. All right, so let's just take a couple moments to sit quietly together, letting those words settle. All right, so now I'd like to give you a chance to talk among yourselves, to engage around this topic. And these small groups are a chance for you to, it's really powerful to be able to articulate your understanding, to articulate where where you're seeing things. Also articulate where you're confused, like, I just don't know what this is about. And also connecting and hearing other people. It really is a powerful way for your practice to grow, is to be able to be in relationship, to be in sangha, to really dialogue. You see this in the suttas again and again, this delight of talking about the Dharma. I mean, where else do you get to talk about this kind of stuff without people saying, what are you talking about? Everyone knows what you're talking about. You can kind of go from that assumption, that common experience. So the questions I'd like you to talk about is really, what's the role? I scribbled this out and my handwriting is getting worse and worse. What is the role of discipline in our practice and also our life? You know, when I say our life, not only what we do in life, but also how we engage our understanding into our life. What's the role of discipline and what's the role of gentleness versus firmness in that discipline? So how does discipline show up in your practice? Sitting every day, how you sit, how you work with the mind that wanders. And what's the role of being gentle with that training? And what's the role of firmness? And is that maybe one and the same? Does that make sense? All right, so those here in person, maybe we can do groups of 3 to 4, and those online, Bob, can you set them up into groups of about 4 to 5? And we'll come back in 20 minutes and have a larger group discussion. Okay, I think everyone's back now. Great. Okay, so I'm curious to see what you talked about, how any questions you might have, or sharing around ox riding pictures, this sense of taming the ox, or also just generally about your practice. Those are all welcome. Okay, Carla and Ian, go ahead.
Yeah, I wanted to share something that I was just telling my group about. I really tried to practice with the homework this week, which I don't always do. And the most interesting observation for me was the effect that the word gentle had on me. For some reason, it really jumped out at me when I read the instructions. So when I was trying, you know, to sort of bring a little more discipline, effort, every time I would bring the mind back, I would literally say to myself in my head, I would just say that word. I would just say, gentle, gentle. And it was, what I realized is I compared it with the word kindness, because we talk about kindness and loving kindness a lot too. And that word kindness has always felt more abstract to me, more just like a concept and a little more difficult. It doesn't automatically sort of invoke an embodied experience. But the word gentle had that effect for me. It was not the idea of acting in a gentle way. It immediately invoked sort of a physical experience of, you know, being physically gentle, almost like very kindly, affectionately touching myself, touching my mind, guiding it back. It just is that sensation. And that was extremely helpful. I was just able to really connect with it, and it felt very supportive. And it felt supportive of the discipline also in a way that I'm not entirely clear about yet. But it felt like when I used that word and that sensation, it had a calming effect on the mind. There wasn't that much struggle to then bring it back to more of a place of balance pretty quickly in that moment.
Thank you, Carla. That's a, I think, a very helpful reflection. Just a couple comments. Kind of starting with what you, just the thing you very last thing said, is that by being, using that word gentle, you found there's a lot less struggle coming back. And that's, I think that's such a key piece. And how, let's say we said harsh every time we want to come back, which is kind of what we say to ourselves. We don't realize it, but that's often an attitude. There's in that struggle, like somehow I've made a mistake. I have to yank my attention back. I've failed again. And there's just this tension that arises. But by having that word gentle, you know, that really, you know, showed you that resonance, with that word gentle. That's such a key piece of how do we practice, you know, practicing in a way that doesn't keep bringing that tension in. And just to kind of highlight too, just the way you really observe that cause and effect of those, that word. And how kindness has that abstractness, and how, you know, for you that word gentleness, really, you really got a lot of purchase on it. I think that's something I think we also learn from, you know, whether or not gentleness works for you or gentle works, but noticing when you get that purchase, when that really clicks, because words have a lot of power, they have a lot of conditioning. And for some reason, we, you know, a teacher might use a particular word that just misses the mark. And then they accidentally use a different word and suddenly it clicks. Or maybe we become just habitual, a word that's really worked for a while. At some point it becomes a little, we become kind of conditioned to it or desensitized to it. Or what's the word like with, you know, if you take a medicine, sometimes your body just becomes, you know, desensitized. You have to keep changing it. So, but the important thing is to notice when it really grabs purchase, when it really lands, when it really transforms how you see. And you gave a great description of how gentleness did that for you. And I hope it did that for many people. It's, you know, just that gentle. It's almost like we're learning to be, you know, like the movie, The Horse Whisperer. We're learning to be whisperers for our own minds. Just that gentleness of how do we tame our attention? How do we bring our attention back? And that gentleness in the long run is actually much, much more productive, much more helpful. So thank you, Carla. about here in the room? Anyone like to share anything or ask anything? He makes a slow sweep across, and everyone looks a little self-conscious. That's fine. I understand. It's sometimes hard to speak in a group. Okay, anyone online like anything to share or ask?
Well, I had a question about when you mentioned trust. The ox started to trust.
Yes.
And then was not so errant, or, you know, that was the sense I got. So I just wondered if you could talk more about that. Is that an important element of all this?
Yes, yeah, I think it definitely is an important element. So around that, hopefully you heard that. Did you hear that question okay online? Yeah, good. The word trust, that when the ox starts to trust, then it's just that starts to follow us more naturally. And I think that's it's really an important word, because like if you ever have tried to train like a pet or an animal, or even just the training that we do as parents, there's a way that the child or the animal starts to trust your intention. Like, okay, you're really there to support them, to you have their well being at your heart. And when, you know, when a teacher is doing that, when someone really gets that, then there's a trust that happens, right? And then there's the easy, much easier to follow that. But until that's there, yeah, there's that sense of, okay, maybe what is really the intentionality behind this training, or who's training it? And so this is where the discernment comes in our own practice. Is like, okay, whoever is instructing me or telling me what to do, what is their intention behind that? So when we do that for ourselves, a lot of it is learning, okay, what's our intention, is actually maybe refining or clarifying our deepest intention. You know, an intention to control ourselves, to be, you know, to be whatever the idea of a right meditator is, or is it to eliminate, to understand our ignorance, to see through our ignorance, to see the end of our suffering, to open our hearts, to understand liberation. So when our intention starts to shift, then, you know, when our intention shifts, our attention shifts too. It's actually similar to what Carla was speaking of with that word gentleness, because that's the way that we direct our attention, the way we work of ourselves, is like the way that the intentions, we're kind of creating this kind of schism of us looking at our attention. When we start to come from that gentleness, there's something in us that relaxes. It's like, okay, I know you're not trying to harm me. You're actually here for my well-being. Does that help? Is there anything else around that?
I guess I was seeing the ox as sort of, I don't know how to explain it really. The ox has to trust life, or trust, the unknown, because trust that they can, that the ox can just give in or let go or let be or something like that. So that just is another element of the trust, not necessarily just of the teacher, but of the universe. Does that make sense?
It makes sense. Yes. Yeah. That's a nice way of looking at it, because at a certain point in our practice, it becomes much more around surrender, of releasing. And especially when we start to really understand some of those roots of how we identify, how we create the sense of self, the way we create suffering, we start to be, okay, but if I don't do that, what am I? Who am I? And there is a sense of trust. There's a sense of, okay, I'm going to trust this enough to let down my protection, let down my guard, let go of my sense of control, and to surrender something that is unknown. Yeah, I think that's a wonderful way to look at this. That is that trusting of where the path is unfolding, even though it's beyond what we know at this point. All right, thank you. All right. I see Judith. Go ahead.
Yeah. Could you talk a little bit more about the whip and the rope? Because that doesn't sound very gentle. And it's kind of, what do they symbolize or represent as far as the practice is concerned?
All right. Yeah. There is that paradox of the whip and the rope and how it gets, how it gets kind of, it really seems different opposed to this gentleness. And so, you know, part of it is that kind of unflinching firmness of direction, that unflinching, okay, this is what we're doing right now. And often we do that in a way that creates a level of maybe inner harshness and, you know, difficulty toward ourselves, because that's what we've learned how to go through life. So it makes sense that that's going to kind of be applied to this. And then, you know, depending on the tradition, sometimes there is a lot of a sense of the whip and the rope, you know, that sense of strictness, that sense of striving, that sense of really robust energy applying. So we're kind of adapting again this Zen teaching into more of our Vipassana style. But even, you know, even in certainly in the Vipassana style and the insight world, there's still a lot of that kind of whip and rope depending on who the teacher is. But so all that being said, you know, how does it apply to you is what the bottom line is. And so think of it as just that, you know, that clarity of structure, of firmness. So, you know, I draw upon my years as a parent and how there's certainly times that there's a firmness, a very unyielding firmness is needed for my child to relax, to know, you know, she may not relax, she may push against that, but there's that firmness. And it's, again, with the intentionality behind it of well-being and a bigger sense of knowing what's hopefully best. There's also the deep honesty of knowing my own inner experience. Like when I'm maybe trying to be firm when I'm really just scared, or I'm being overly firm when I don't need to be. That's really where the Dharma and parenting come together well, is that you know your own internal reaction, your own intention much more clearly. And that kind of clarifies and helps how you parent. But it's that firmness, like the know of love, the sense of no, that's a clear structure, that clear line. So in terms of our meditation, you know, the mind will just, you know, will just go. It likes to just wander those fields, those dusty roads, those mud-filled swamps. It, you know, just it loves to go in there. So I remember early on just really trying to bring my attention back again and again. And yeah, there's probably more harshness, more strictness than I needed, but I almost needed enough of that to quiet things down. So it's kind of like seeing that maybe that extra firmness is needed to let the mind settle enough, and then we can become softer with it. Another way to say it is our practice, you know, if we look back over our years, we should become more and more subtle, more and more finesse, more and more gentleness, less effort is needed if we're practicing in a way that's deepening. And sometimes in the midst of life throws us something that's really unstabilizing, that's really distressing. Then, you know, we bring that firmness. Okay, I'm going to really release this mind state. I'm going to release this anger, this impulse to be angry, and go into the direct moment's experience of that anger. I'm going to really connect with this moment. You know, so that's the way I tend to look at it. Not that we, you know, so that whip and this kind of came up last week too, that whip and the rope, it's like we can easily get caught in that. So a lot of, here's the last thing I'll say about that is just noticing your own tendency toward your practice. And that's going to probably be mirrored in your relationships too. Do you tend to be a little bit more, let's say, marshmallowy, kind of don't want to put anybody out? There's that sense of, you know, not wanting to put too much structure, not to stand up for yourself. Or you're the other side that you tend to be too structuring, too harsh, too controlling. Just kind of noticing where you are. Practicing opposite of that will often be an area of growth for you.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, that helps.
Thank you, Judith. So what else is out there in the world, in your life, your practice?
Tim?
Yeah, go ahead, Kaba.
I was thinking about, just when you were talking about the whip and the rope, how the poet chose an ox. He didn't choose a donkey. You know, he chose a 1,000-pound animal. At the same time, he chose an animal that's a domestic animal. So it's inclined toward being trained. And the drawing of the person, like you were saying earlier, it's a little person. Even a whip and a rope are pretty illusory. You will not be able to hold an ox that wants to get away from you. So I just was thinking about that image as you were talking, that there's an inclination toward me and of me in this creature, and I need structure. I wouldn't walk up to an ox with nothing. Yeah, so just playing with that.
Yeah, thank you, Kaba. Yeah, the image carries a lot of, I think it's lovely to reflect on it over the month and just kind of let it grow and different, your psyche starts to see different elements of that. And yeah, you're right. The ox is kind of inclined by nature to be tamed. I mean, that's kind of where it tends to go. And, you know, versus like a wild bear or something. You know, we're not a grizzly bear. We're dealing with an ox it benefits by being tamed. And so I think it's often helpful too to look, okay, what does the ox really represent? You know, where is it representing in this picture, in my practice, and holding that really in a way that allows it to evolve. So if the ox is like our true nature, the wildness of the ox is that maybe the power of delusion, of separation, of ignorance, right? The way, the greed, hatred, and delusion, that element that's kind of mixed in with that true nature. And so the training, the catching the ox, the training the ox is learning to quiet that, to start to see through that. So that true nature comes to the forefront. And there's a way that we, you know, the sense of me as a little kid holding this ox, that I can actually be in relationship to that true nature. And yeah, it is, I think that's a nice way of thinking of it, that it is, it's really working. That's kind of naturally wants to go that way, into that taming, into that connection. And the ox, I think another way to look at it is the ox, we're trying to tame the ox, but the ox is really, what's being tamed is our own sense of separation, of ignorance. That's what's really being tamed. And so the ox, at some point, really, us and the ox come together. All right, thank you, Kaba. All right, so Carlito.
Hi, Tim. I just wanted to share a practice insight I had. It's related to what we're talking about, sort of the grit and the firmness. But for me, what came out of it was I was sitting, as one does, and you know, kind of getting a little frustrated with just the dusty road and the muddy swamp, and just realizing that all of that was there to help me and protect me, and that this overwhelming kind of compassion for my mind just bubbled up. It's like, oh, you're there to try to protect me in your own way. And I almost want to verbalize it out loud so that I can help myself remember it and not let that insight disappear. But anyway, that was just something I wanted to share. And, it, you know, for me, the thoughts are like a buffer to maybe very painful nonverbal angst that's sitting there under the covers or whatever it is. But it's like it's immature mechanism for or dealing with something that's scary and painful. And that, you know, that, that realization has brought up a lot of compassion for that process, I guess. But yeah, I just wanted to share that.
Yeah, thank you, Carlito. Yeah, that sense of seeing those patterns that, you know, from one perspective, just lead us into the mud and the dusty roads and seem like they have no use at all. And yet from that perspective, we're seeing it really as a place of division, of separation, that I'm seeing it, I'm observing it, and I want to get rid of it. And that's actually embedded in that very perspective is the separation, is the duality. And then when you start to actually appreciate, well, this pattern, even though it seemed like it doesn't serve me, you know, it's an attempt. It's like the mind is trying to help you out. It's trying to find a way to cope with something that's difficult. And that sense of compassion, the heart softening, you know, the kind of the sweetness, the tenderness and relating to that, that's like starting to heal that schism. And we see something that is outside of ourselves, which inherently isn't. And that's that coming together, the ox, you are starting to come back together. You're healing that schism of what's acceptable and what's not. Yeah, so beautiful. Thank you, Carlito. Yeah, go ahead, Alan. Yeah, if you don't mind grabbing that.
Let me turn the video as we on. Were talking, the word faith came up, and I know this is a word that we don't typically use. It's more Judeo-Christian, but there's a certain amount of faith, I think, in the training, in the practice. Mm-hmm. And the image of the ox and the training of that, I think there's a certain amount of faith in that the ox will be trained. And so you get up every day with your ox, and some days are not good days for training. And they're really hard, but you just hope that, you know, at some point it's going to get better. And I mentioned that I sit with a Zen group usually, and we sort of say, you know, you sit in order to sit. There is no goal to sitting, but there is sort of a hope that something, right? Mm-hmm. However you articulate it. And I guess that's, I find that really, I find the image of the ox and the training, powerful. In that sense, that you, that there is a hope. You begin with the hope that something will come of it.
That's right. Great, thank you, Alan. That's there's in Theravadin. There's the five faculties or five powers. First one is faith, and there's the energy, and then there's mindfulness. There's all these different things that start from that sense of faith, because why would we start the practice if there wasn't any, it was no hope? And then the hope, you know, like the Four Noble Truths, that's like a statement of faith, like, okay, there's suffering, but there's also the end of suffering. And that's what really brings us in, because if you don't have that, then why would, you know, we would be discouraged. And it helps us really get through those times of struggle, just feel like the mind is just completely wild. The ox, to use this analogy, is just, you don't know where it is. It's, you're looking for it, but you have that faith, and it comes from your own experience. It comes from your teachers. It comes from listening to the Dharma. Okay, there is this potential, and that's essentially a huge part of the practice, is that we need to have that faith that there is something beyond what we can currently see for us to practice. Like Soto Zen, understand that basically the idea is you're already the Buddha. You're just sitting there to it and manifests. I mean, that's a statement of great faith. You're sitting there till the practice transforms you. Yeah. So thank you for sharing that. It's important. Yeah. We could take really all the, maybe all, there's not most of the teachings, and kind of look at it from this lens. How does faith show up in these pictures? And how is the five faculties, how does the hindrances show up? How does the Four Noble Truths show up? Yeah, it's because this is a Buddhist teaching. Right, thank you. All right, so we will continue with another talk next week, you know, exploring this picture some more. we'll see what arises from that. I don't know what's going to come up yet, but I'm sure it will be interesting for me at least, hopefully for you too, and helpful. All right. So thank you all for your engagement and your questions. It really helps us, you know, all kind of get to understand this teaching from a different lens. Each voice is valued. All right. So have a wonderful evening, and I hope to see you next week.